Are we ready to begin? I mean, we all settled down and quiet and everything. So we're going to continue our discussion of the fundamental principles of Varnashram Dharma. We're talking mostly about Varna, not so much ashram. Maybe we'll have time to talk about ashram a bit. Today I want to begin this discussion by the topic of vritti. Vritti means means of livelihood. When it says guna and karma, work, their qualities and their work, which determines a person's varna, part of what's meant by karma is also vritti, how you are supposed to make your money. And I think it is a wise and fundamental insight of social science that in the society, the way the society produces its wealth, what its means of livelihood are, has immense implications throughout the whole society that you ordinarily wouldn't expect. I think this insight was investigated very fully by Karl Marx. Of course, he turned it into a kind of economic determinism, which is not our position we want to hold. But I want to give you some examples from ISKCON, at least in North America. Just how our society makes its money changes lots of things in the society. I'm giving you this example because it'll be easier for us to understand. When our movement first started in North America, its only means of maintaining itself was through Sankirtan. Sankirtan meant, in the beginning, going out in the streets and chanting, but also we distributed pamphlets and Back to Godhead magazines and got donations. And then this developed into a more professionalized class of book distributors who were able to get much bigger donations. And that was the wealth of our society in North America. Then in North America, what happened is we became so good at extracting donations that at a certain point, about 1977, one discovered that the American public was completely irritated at the Hare Krishna movement, that everyone hated us because of our expertise as extracting donations from people, particularly in airports. And this finally dawned on the leadership what was going on when we began to lose court cases. We had won a series of court cases expanding our Sankirtan. And so they then made a decision to separate, and in 77 the GBC made a decision to separate book distribution from money collecting. And this led to various other enterprises for making money, selling Korean paintings, distributing baseball hats, sports team stickers and other compromised goods. Things like that, carved candles, unrelated to our main purpose. And the idea was that way we'll be able to distribute books and we won't be so much pressure to get money. But these money collecting activities, even though they had nothing to do directly with preaching Krishna consciousness, were called Sankirtan. I remember, actually it was Budge Bihari when I first became GBC of Detroit. He wanted to take a van to go out and to the airport so they can do some book distributor. And the temple president said, no, we need it for Sankirtan. He meant the people that were going out with stickers and collecting money at some football game or something. Just the Then what happened about 1988 is this form of money collecting gradually turned into became gradually in most places quite dishonest. Not everywhere, but in most places it became quite dishonest. And even when it was honest, the devotees didn't like it and it wasn't good for their spiritual life. And so the GBC in North America in 1987, and at this point, this was me. I was elected to the GBC in that year and was the North American GBC chairman. We made a decision that we're going to go, as we say, cold turkey, that we were not going to make our money this way anymore, and that our money was going to come from congregational donations. We had actually a very big congregation whom we had never really cultivated as donors. It was mostly Indians in America, I mean half Indians, but everybody was thinking, oh, we don't need to give money. The Indian people liked it. Here we can come to a temple, you don't have those priests bugging you all the time for, demanding money like they do in India, you know. So we had to begin to turn to our congregation as donors, and that's what we began to do in a systematic way in North America. And of course, as soon as we pulled the plug, North America, ISKCON went broke, and we're only now beginning to recover, but I think we're on a firmer basis. But at any rate, when all our donations were coming by having Sankirtan devotees, so a young person would come to the temple and we would immediately preach, drop everything and go out on Sankirtan. That's your best thing for you to do. We need you to do that. This is spreading, getting the books out. That's what Prabhupada wanted. And we're thinking that are you in college? What is the use of mundane education in the slaughterhouse for the young? You should drop out of college. Should you want to get married? No. Everyone should be brahmachari, brahmacharini. Marriage is the dark well, this, that, the other thing. And people saying, yeah, I really want to get married. No. It's just that. In this way, we were distributing books and our money was coming in. Now our idea is, in North America, that our money will come from our congregation. And then we also noticed that, at least, what happened, of course, in the course of time, another thing, incidentally, is one discovered that the number of people who really wanted to remain lifetime celibates people was rather small, and that a large number, the majority of men and women, would want to enter into married life, and they were doing that anyway. And, you know, when they were finally doing that, they were a little bitter because here I am, I have to start my marriage life, support a family, nobody taught me anything. You told me to drop out of school, now I can only get bad paying jobs and da da. So in North America, the means of livelihood of ISKCON has changed. Now when a young person comes, we usually don't counsel them to completely drop out of school. Maybe say, well, take a semester off or a year off and move in the temple and get trained up. Then go back to school. Because we're thinking, well, this person is going to probably be a householder, and one day they will, be making a livelihood. And one day they'll support ISKCON, actually. So it's good if they get a good paying means of livelihood, so they'll have enough money. And so it's had this, without, not people consciously planning, I think, but just that means of livelihood has had various sorts of impact. The way we treat, in America, we had a huge congregation, which as long as our income was coming from Sankirtan, we pretty much didn't pay that much attention to. Because our thinking, our preaching was directed to shave your head and move in the temple. So we had all these Indian people, we had all these, quote-unquote fringes, people who were immune to shaving their head and moving into the temple. We'd go, there'd be a Sunday feast, the temple would be packed with people, and we'd say there's nobody to preach to. Because that's what preaching meant. You had to convince somebody to drop everything and move into the temple. Then one day we noticed, this is our congregation. If we're going to start asking them to support, now you have to, pay some attention to them. You have to help them in their spiritual life. They're not going to move in the temple, but still there are people. And your attitude toward your congregation starts to change. All this is very much related to your means of livelihood. So that's just to show how means of livelihood is very important. And that's why in talking about Varnashram Dharma, Prabhupada emphasizes very much a agrarian, agricultural, rural economy and not an industrial economy, because that also, as a basic means of wealth of the whole civilization, has immense implications. Well, we'll get to that later. What I want to do now is I have here from folio. I just couldn't put the burden on people to photocopy any more things, so I didn't have this to pass out. But this will fall over if we're not careful here. In our collection of folio collection, I'm going to read to you from a lecture that Prabhupada gave in July of 1976. This was in Chicago. It was actually just before he came to Philadelphia. And at that time, Prabhupada was lecturing on the story of Ajamil. So this is a lecture on the sixth canto, first chapter. It's text 22. So if you want to look this up. So in there, he's talking about how when Ajamil fell down, he could no longer earn his livelihood according to the proper methods of a brahmana. In fact, because he was so fallen, his means of livelihood were bhangdi akshay, that is to say, kidnapping or robbing people, holding them up, cheating at gambling, and stealing. Those were his means of livelihood. Prabhupada says, one must earn his livelihood. You always notice this practical thing. Everybody has to earn his livelihood. One is reminded of the immortal words of Bertolt Brecht, Erst kommt das Fressen, dann kommt die Moral, you know. first comes your feed, then comes your morals. So it was understood that everybody has got their means of livelihood somehow or other. So his was fallen down, Prabhupada says, to the sixth class man, stealing, thieving, and cheating. And then Prabhupada goes and he talks about the means of livelihood for the first class, second class, third class, fourth class, and then below the fifth class, and then what Ajamila was, which is below the fifth class. And if we look at this means of livelihood, I think it'll tell us a lot about Varnashram Dharma. So Prabhupada says, first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, or lower than that, everyone must have his means of livelihood. Right? So what is the means of livelihood for the first class man? And he quotes, Patana Patana, Yajana Yajana, Dana Pratigraha. You know that, Patana Patana? Studying the Vedas and teaching the Vedas, yajana yajana, performing sacrifice of deity worship and doing it for others or teaching others, and then accepting in charity and giving in charity. These are the six activities of a brahmana. He must become a learned scholar, Prabhupada says, but he just can't learn. He has to distribute, he says. This is the first class man, he must become a learned scholar. If he's not a scholar, what nonsense will he teach? And the next business is to teach others, to make them disciple. Notice for Prabhupada, this teaching others and making them disciples are almost interchangeable terms. And it's important to realize that. Because the nature of the relationship in a Varna society, Varnashram society, between student and teacher is the relationship between a spiritual master and a disciple. There's no difference. Now we have a different kind of society which is based on a contract and the paying of fees. As Prabhupada says, this is not allowed. Then he says, formerly, even 50 or 60 years ago in India, a brahmana would not accept anyone's service. This is called Shvavritti, the occupational duty of a dog. And neither the Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, or Vaishyas can become an employee of anyone else. All these three people have to be economically independent. If you get a paycheck from somebody, you're a Shudra. Or at least you're engaged in the occupational duty of a Shudra. As you see, it's almost practically impossible to live in today's society without getting a paycheck. But if we're thinking about setting up Brahmanas, Vaishyas, or Kshatriyas, the first thing is economically independent. The individual businessman, the entrepreneur, the small shopkeeper, if you're a Vaishya, but not part of a modern corporation where you receive a paycheck. That's not the first class way to go. It will be hard to get there, but it probably can be done. Anyway, he would not accept anyone's service because whatever he has knowledge, he would sit down anywhere underneath a tree or in the corridor of somebody's house, and he will invite the village small children, and they will go, and he will teach little grammar, little mathematics gradually. And the children will bring from their father and mother, somebody will bring rice, somebody will bring dal, somebody will bring something. So he had no necessity of making any contract. That you give me so many dollars, then I shall teach you. No. Free. Free education. In this way, India was free education. Now, I just want to stop here and think about this for a while. What kind of society is it where a teacher can just sit down and begin teaching and automatically his maintenance will come? He doesn't even have to ask. He doesn't have to ask. There doesn't have to be a contract. Yes, you give me so much tuition and I'll teach you. What kind of a society is it? Again, when it comes to worshipping the deity Patana Patana, Yajana Yajana, and his livelihood, again for deity worship or doing brahminical services ritual, by voluntary contribution, whatever people will give, that's all right. People used to give brahmana. People were very honest. This man is teaching our children. He does not charge. This man is teaching me how to worship, how to become well-behaved. So they have no scarcity, enough. So this is the nature of this society. And if we start to think about it, you see it's very, very different from the methods of an industrial society. And what you see in this case with the Brahmanas is what happens when somebody just sits down and starts to give. He's rendering a service. He's teaching. A Brahman is teaching the children or whoever comes. He's teaching. He's not asking anything in exchange. What should you feel? Hey, it's free. Just go get it, you know, until he starts charging. No, you feel an obligation. That this person, I feel indebted. This person is giving me something. I want to reciprocate. I want to give something in exchange. I want to render some service. Here he's giving. He's not asking a thing. Whatever I have, maybe a lot and maybe a little, let me give something in return. So this society is a very strong sense of mutual obligations. No contracts. It was just given freely and everything was going on in that way. This is how it was happening. So this is a very, very different sort of social bond than we have today. And remember also, as from last time, this is a hierarchical society. So the Brahmana is there at the head of society. And there's something else about this society, that there's a notion in the hierarchical society that blessings come from up to down. In the hierarchy is actually, that hierarchy is the direction of the flowings of blessings. The original font, or the fountainhead of all blessings, is of course Krishna. And everyone could understand that. Here's a few places where Prabhupada talks about this. I'm just taking out of Bhagavatam purports. Perfection, Kripa Siddhi, he says, perfection attained simply by the blessings of a superior person. There's following regulations, but many persons have achieved perfection simply by the blessings of a spiritual master or of a superior. So here's this notion that in this relationship, and we're talking especially about brahmanas, that one can get blessings from them. That is, in the process of learning or teaching, there's a factor which normally in a like a normal material academic relation we're not very conscious of, although actually it's even there then, that there's something that a teacher can give you that's a little, how shall I say, intangible. It's not just a matter of read this book and read that book, but it's wisdom. And he can impart that by blessings. Prabhupada mentions that when one is impudent toward a highly authorized devotee, one is punished by the laws of nature. And he mentions the punishment. The duration of life is diminished, and he loses the blessings of superior persons. Again, another place, Prabhupada says, if there is blessings of higher authority, everything can be achieved. There is no doubt. And Prabhupada mentions somewhere that that in the course of his preaching work, materialistic people come to him, and they offer their obeisances to take blessings. So there's a notion that the person can give you something. And again, he mentions again in Srimad Bhagavatam, the blessings of the spiritual master are more powerful than one's personal endeavor for spiritual advancement. So we know that we've heard these things. But this is actually a feature of the whole hierarchical society. There's also blessings from kings, there's blessings from parents, there's blessings, Prabhupada will talk maybe the blessings of a loving mother, of which we are all very much in need in our childhood. So then Prabhupada mentions, I'm going to look now at, this is a verse and purport from the ninth canto, first chapter, 18th text, the blessings of a qualified brahmana. Especially what they can do. Now, he says there's a condition of brahmanas being able to give potent blessings. The text says, Bhagavatam says, when brahmanas are free from envy, untruthfulness, unnecessary pride, grudges, disturbance by the opulence of others, and false prestige, their blessings never go in vain. Nice, huh? 9.1.18. This is talking about why Nanda Maharaj took Krishna in his lap and invited the various brahmanas to perform some sacrifices. Nanda Maharaj was very confident about the qualifications of the brahmanas and their blessings. He was fully confident that simply if the good brahmanas showered their blessings, the child Krishna would be happy. The blessings of qualified brahmanas can bring happiness not only to Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but to everybody. Actually, if one had qualified brahmanas, really all they have to do is go around and give blessings. Really, that would be the biggest advancement you could make in society. They just go around and give blessings. In human society, and he says, so you need these brahmanas Krishna required the blessings of the brahmanas. What then is to be said of others in human society? Therefore, there must be an ideal class of men, brahmanas, who can bestow blessings upon others, namely the kshatriyas, vaishyas, and shudras, so that everyone will be happy. And then he goes on and talks about the how they have to be brahmanas with sama, dhamma, sacham, and so on. Then Prabhupada goes on to say that just by being born doesn't, in a brahmana family, doesn't make you qualified to give potent blessings. He says, the blessings of brahmanas who are not envious, disturbed, or puffed up with pride and false prestige, and who are fully qualified with truthfulness, will be useful. Therefore, a class of men must be trained as brahmanas from the very beginning. Brahmachari Gurukule, in the Gurukula. With the Krishna consciousness movement, we are trying to introduce such brahmanas in society. And he says brahmanas must be ultimately Vaishnavas and so on. Then later on in the purport, when he's talking about Brahman is one who understands Brahman, and he's quoting the verse Brahma Bhuta Prasanatma, and then he comes to Sama Sarveshu Bhuteshu. He sees everyone as the same. Prabhupada glosses that or explains this. Sama Sarveshu Bhuteshu, he is ready to bestow blessings upon everyone equally. That's the nature of the Brahmana. He doesn't stint on this. So in this way, Prabhupada describes what it takes. In another place, in the ninth canto, he mentions, we learn from many Vedic literatures that a benediction or curse given by the demigods never proves false. By performing austerities and penances, by controlling the senses and mind, and by achieving full knowledge of the absolute truth, one is fully cleansed of material contamination. Then one's words and blessings, like those of the demigods, are never a failure. So if one is qualified, then your blessings are potent. Now, Prabhupada mentions that well, let me say that therefore, one of the cement, or one of the most important skills that one needs to learn in a Varnashram society is how to invoke blessings. Here's a person who has this potency. How do I get that person's blessings? Blessings means, I think, on the most basic level, just that person's favorable attitude or good wishes. If that person is potent, then those favorable attitude and good wishes turn into either a spiritual or even a material benediction, depending on what I'm after in life. But this is so this is how to invoke blessings. From whom? From the superior. So Prabhupada talks about this. You know, I mean, there's this famous here in the Bhagavad Gita when he talks about the verse Tadvidi Pranipatena. He says in here, talking about the student-teacher relationship, unless there is submission and service, inquiries from the learned spiritual master will not be effective. One must be able to pass the test of the spiritual master, and when he, the spiritual master, sees the genuine desire of the disciple, he automatically blesses the disciple with genuine spiritual understanding. Notice that word automatic. It means that when the spiritual master or the teacher sees that the disciple is fully eager to serve and to learn, to be receptive, to take everything seriously, then it says it's automatic. The heart of the brahmana, the teacher, just opens up of its own accord. And by those blessings, one gets spiritual advancement. Those of us who even in material life have run across a very, very good teacher, can even see in the material level something like this goes on. If you run across someone who is both an expert in some particular field, I mean, has mastered a particular area of knowledge, and who is also a very good teacher, a lot of times one discovers that if you go to that teacher and just demonstrate how much you want to learn what they have, you will get from that teacher much more than anybody else who just simply takes notes. It's a fact. And you'll want to render service, you'll want to help you. And gradually, by pleasing this teacher, by being ear to learn, because a good teacher looks for nothing more than somebody who really wants to take what they have to give. And one of the frustrations of the teacher is having a whole lot to give and having just bounce off students who are not receptive. You find a receptive student who shows is receptive, then the teacher can tell things. And you learn from such teachers really amazing things, not just about the particular subject, but about how to learn, the mastery of something, how to understand things, and especially if it involves any particular realized knowledge or applied skill, how to do it, because that applied skill is something that's wisdom and not just. You learn, like if you're just studying somebody who knows how to do research, you learn from this teacher something that he can't really lay down in principles, but how to tell what is important from what is not important, how to have really good judgment, just in, say, you're learning history. And the only way you can know is if it's a very intangible kind of a process. What we see in the relationship that we call spiritual master-disciple is almost the perfect student-teacher relationship by which genuine knowledge can be passed on in its full. And the modern contractual thing where you pay some fee and somebody teaches you something is really a pale reflection of this sort of very intimate and deep relationship that is there between student and teacher in Vedic society. I mean, once in a while it will happen in a Karmi society. And if you have a teacher like that, that teacher will spend much more time with you than is required by the amount of your fee. It's really over and above what they give, because that teacher will respond in that way if it's a good teacher. He goes on about the brahmanas, by the way, as far as whatever people give, he keeps. And then Prabhupada said he would use as much as he required. The balance he will give in charity. Not that he will keep in stock for tomorrow. No, that is not brahmanas business. Whatever has come today, I use it for my necessities of life and balance. I give to the poor or somebody else, somebody, or make some festival. I find some way to distribute to the appropriate persons any excess I have. So this is what the Brahmin's business is. He's to be austere, actually knower of the absolute truth, and can deliver it to others. So the social relations here is where do we see these kinds of deep personal relationships where there's a deep sense of natural mutual obligation without any necessity of contracts, of arrangements like that? Well, we see it in pre-modern society, really. It's maybe that distinction. Am I right? Gemeinschaft, Gesellschaft. I mean, it's a society that's organized in a community, a village, a small town where people trust each other, where one person makes a promise and it's kept, no questions asked, no need to have your lawyer draw up a document, where there's very deep bonds of trust and commitment. This is the kind of society that's envisioned. And that kind of society, where these primary relationships are there, of deep bonds and commitment. This precisely is what's eroded away gradually over the course of time in an industrial society. I think all historians and social historians have talked about this, and that generally people say that the condition of modern human beings is a condition of uprootedness, deracinated. The Shakespeare uses that word, deracinated, uprootedness, and alienation, just like Marx talked about how the worker is alienated in the means of industrial mode of production. So we live our modern day lives are our lives of uprootedness, of alienation, of superficial relationships. In the agrarian society, you can imagine, human beings, Prabhupada says, are meant to live in villages. That's what, and villages, and also in an agrarian society, you had the so-called extended family, where not just parents and children. Nowadays, we have what they call the nuclear family. Two parents and children, but now it's even one parent and children. And the children, as everybody keeps getting divorced and remarried, the children, you know, pass, go different places. As gradually, I mean, the family is in an industrial society an increasingly obsolete entity, which is why insanity is increasing gradually. The World Health Organization says mental health will be the biggest public health problem in the future. And there's good reasons for this. So people's relationships like this are relationships of uprootedness, alienation, enemy. Nobody knows what the rules and regulations are anymore. People often do not even are not raised in a particular place. They move from one place to another place to another place without any roots. The family, of course, scatters from one place, don't live together anymore. This is the modern condition of life. People are taken care of. It used to be in an agrarian society, parents would grow old. People would take care of their parents. Nowadays, it's the government that does it. It's nursing homes, and so on. It's all passed in the hands of secondary. We have a state that's taken the place of a family, or some such arrangement like that. Because this is part of the breakdown. The ability of people to care for each other in a deep way has been eroded. And this has very bad consequences. So here's a society where you can just imagine what it was like. A brahmana would simply give what he has learned and not have to ask, and people would feel so much obliged that naturally they'd bring something and give in return. And actually they would want to get that person's blessings. Anyway, they understood the potency that these blessings gave. The student understands, what do I have to do if I want my spiritual master to bestow on me everything he can? I have to somehow or other invoke the blessings of the spiritual master. I have to please him by service, by sincere desire, by attentive questionings. And then I know that somehow or other there will be within me this ability to soak up more and more spiritual knowledge. Prabhupada goes on to mention the livelihood of kshatriyas. Kshatriya's income is to take some tax. What is that tax? Not in money. People are engaged in agricultural work. So whatever he has produced, he gives 25% to the ruler. That's all. That includes income tax, this tax, that tax, no more tax. He means to say not some income tax, some value-added tax, some sales tax, some this, but just one lump sum, 25%. That's it. That's what you get. If you don't have any income, you don't pay any tax. Brahmins were tax-free. They didn't pay tax. And that was what good to the ruler. Again, there's an obligation. What does the ruler do for us, the kshatriya? He bears arms on our behalf. He gives protection. The kshatriya is one who uses strength and power to protect others. When there is no kshatriya, then we are always in danger from rogues and thieves and whatever in our own midst and from external aggression. When there is no effective government, then it's like everybody's like a cowboy. You know, you have to have your gun by your side to protect yourself, to watch out. There can't be any peace. As soon as the kshatriya says, I'll protect you, then immediately there can be peace. That kshatriya, he has has his own lifestyle, but thing is, he's ready to die. He's a person who's committed to lay his life on the line to see that everybody else can be peaceful. So naturally, you want to, you should be obliged for some. Here's a person who'll lay down his life for you, and also manages and takes care of everything like that, protects from aggression. So that's kshatriya's occupation. It's mentioned more in the seventh canto. Taxes, custom duties, fines when somebody has been guilty of something, there's a levy of fines. And also we find out booty from warfare. It's clean up the battlefield afterwards, all the armor and gold and everything, and take that. That's mentioned in the Krishna book several times, how many carts of golden ornaments they took off of the battlefield when Jarasandha was defeated outside the walls of Mathura. That's kshatriya. Maybe we'll come back to kshatriyas later. But here, Prabhupada goes on to talk about vaishya. Vaishya means produce food grains, krishi, agriculture, not produce food in the slaughterhouse. No, slaughterhouse. Even the sixth class, seventh class man didn't do that. Slaughterhouse, he says. They say the people below the Shudra class, they did not know how to produce food, how to live. That means aborigines in the jungle. They were hunting one animal, then eating. So this is so in other words, civilization means that, see, in order to have a civilization, you have to have surplus production. You know what I mean? The people who are producing the food and whatever you need to eat and live, there has to be more than just them. Because the brahmanas are not really wealth producing. They perform another service, but they don't really produce wealth. Neither do the kshatriyas really produce wealth, unless, you know, they bring some back from a battle or something. But otherwise, they don't produce wealth. The wealth comes from the vaishyas. So they have to produce enough to support everybody else. So that's why and when you have people who have time to study, who have time to read the Vedas, who don't have to spend all their time, how will I eat, how will I live, then you have civilization as possible. I mean, Aristotle points this out a long time ago. You know, you can't have civilization until these basic needs are taken care of and there's surplus. How do we get surplus? Surplus means settled agriculture. Now, when there are aborigines who live in the jungle, that's called a hunter-gathering stage, hunting-gathering, where you hunt little animals and you pick up roots and berries and things like that. But everybody, every day, they have to get up and think, how will I eat? There's not much chance of much division of labor. So according to this conception, civilization really begins where you have the vaishyas who can produce a surplus. And how are they able to produce surplus? Not just by themselves, but by taking service from cows and bulls. If you don't have the added energy from oxen for plowing, you will not be able to produce the requisite surplus. Therefore, human life depends upon the cows and the bulls. And now here again is an obligation. Here is the cow. She's giving me milk. I need milk to perform sacrifice and get ghee. We need milk for animal protein. We need milk for the finer brain or tissues, you know, by which we can understand spiritual life. Here's the bull. Works for me. So I have an obligation. How do I treat these animals? They're my mother and my father. So here again, here's a different kind of relationship between here are the people who are wealth producing, and they have that tendency to be somewhat greedy by nature. One of the characteristics of a Vaishya is they are not satisfied. They never think, I have enough money. That's in the Bhagavatam. The tendency is, you know, always I should have more money. So there's a tendency on the Vaishya to be exploitive. But if they understand that I have to care for the bulls and the cows, which are the source of my wealth, as my mother and father, immediately that puts a limit on exploitation. And it means you live, the bulls, the cows, they become family members. And if you've been to Village Bengal, you see it. You know, the family will live in a mud compound with the cows and the bulls, just like people today live with dogs. The dog's bigger than some of the cows in Bengal. You can live with them a little easier than you can with one of these giant cows that we have here. But this is civilization. Our eatables should be food grains, krishi goraksha, and milk. And this is civilization, he says, not slaughterhouse. Meat eating is meant for the seventh class men who does not know, who remains naked. They can neither produce food, neither cloth in the jungle. It is for them. You see what he's meaning? That these kind of things where you have looms and you can produce lots of cloth and so on. They were not very much expert to maintain a slaughterhouse. So even the Aborigines, they at least what they ate, they were eating meat, but at least they had to hunt it down and so on. And they're far superior, Prabhupada's saying, to the modern civilization, which has slaughterhouses. He says, they were not very much expert to maintain a slaughterhouse. When you need, you can kill one lower animal, not cow. The cow is not available in the jungle. You can have some deer, some boar. So these unimportant animals were killed by them. This is sixth class, not first class, second class, third class, fourth class, no. Then he mentions fourth class man who could not utilize his brain as first class, second class, third class, then he becomes fourth class. His business is to help worker, those higher three classes. So in this way, everyone has his means of livelihood, or the particular means of livelihood. And then beyond that, the jungle man by hunting. And then he mentions what Ajamil had become, the criminal class. Even lower. This class of men, they do not accept any of these livelihood means, but they cheat you. In the big cities, pickpockets, thieves, rogues, and so on. And now the present society is perplexed. Crime, why and what to do? Prabhupada was having an interview with a police lieutenant at that time answering this problem. You are maintaining sixth class, seventh class men. Your education is meant for that. Why are you afraid of crime now? This is the result. Now enjoy the result. As you sow, so you shall reap. You are producing sixth class, seventh class, tenth class men. And you expect that there will be no crime, people will be happy, it will be peaceful. This is not possible. If you want to be happy, peaceful, then you must take this movement, Krishna consciousness, and try to create at least a group of men first class, just as we are doing that. People will see their behavior, their character, their mode of life, and at least they will be attracted. So that's Prabhupada's description of these various means of livelihood. Now, I would say that we could Look at this for a minute. Since we discussed the criminal class of people, that when we look, we have to look now. When Prabhupada, here, Prabhupada.
It's all falling apart.
I'm going to read from a book that was in the American Journal of Psychiatry in 1933. A psychiatrist described the characteristic life of criminals, or what's called delinquents. And this was in 1933. And this psychiatrist didn't particularly like to use the term good or bad, so he described the industrial, social, sexual, and emotional life of delinquents as unorganized, because he didn't want to pass value judgments. But it amounts to the same thing. We okay now on this? Is it not staying?
What should you do? Adjust this to that rod goes further to the left.
The tape is broken. Do we have more tape?
Who put the tape on?
I want to explain this because I just want us to understand how far we are as modern people from any experience of this kind of social bond that is pre-industrial. And actually what we are all today, as Prabhupada says, is the criminal class. Here in 1933, a psychiatrist describes the criminal class. And in the years since 1933, it's almost become the normal class. Here's how he describes. Delinquents or criminals are unorganized in their sexual life as well as in their industrial career, their work life. Even when married, there is no sense of sentiment or of responsibility. They are never heroes of tense love dreams or sacrifice for a woman's love. Of course, this is by Karmi standards, but that's okay. As I said, one of the things we have to learn is how to be attached. With them, love is merely an appetite to be satisfied. When it is satisfied, the object by which it is satisfied is forgotten. Women, as an occasional playmate, appeals to them. Of course, then later, some 30 years later, we have the Playboy. What? Playmate. Playmate of the month, right? Women as someone to work for, to make sacrifices for, to live with in anything like companionship has no meaning for them. Their sexual activity never becomes merged with the mores and thus socialized. I mean, rules and regulations of society. Their sexuality does not evolve into responsibility and sentiment. It thus remains unorganized, and they themselves are uninvolved individuals. In their social life, this psychiatrist finds them, the delinquents, gregarious. That is, they congregate together and talk a lot and socialize a lot. Gregarious without any communal feeling. They must be with others and are uneasy when alone. But there is no deep concern for those whom they meet, no loyalty to men or cause. Emotionally, there is no brooding over the past, no fervent building for the future. Their emotional life is shallow, though often violent enough for short periods of time. Their mood is that which suits the moment. They have never built up in their lives substantial purposes which will weather the vagrant urges of the present moment. And anyway, this is a sort of description. It has become more and more common standard of the way people live. today. So I want to now explain something, because something when Prabhupada first came to preach in America, he said that there is no need for Varnashram Dharma. You look at his early statements in his books also, the ones that are written in India. He said, anyway, it won't be possible in this age, and we're transcendental, he said. Later, he changed his mind and became more and more stressed on Varnashram Dharma. And when he did so, people said, Prabhupada, aren't we Vaishnavas? And Prabhupada said, are we? Are we really? So I think Prabhupada's first, when he saw how a group of young people came to him and with such sincerity and earnestly began to follow him, his initial impression was, wow, this is it. Look at these people that are taking to Krishna consciousness. He was amazed coming to a new country, finding such enthusiasm, and a certain energy you don't find in India, believe me. I guess you could call it American energy, but anyway, whatever it was there. And Prabhupada was very favorably impressed. Later on, he began to learn how much trouble people were having just in the basic maintaining regulative principles and things like that. Then, at one point he used to arrange marriages, you and you, you and you, just like it's done in India, right? You and you, you and you. And then those marriages began to get into trouble. Prabhupada was besieged by letters from husbands talking about their wives, wives talking about their husbands, on and on and on. Domestic difficulties and marriages began to break up. And then somewhere around 1973, Prabhupada said, like Hamlet, let there be no more marriages. He just washed his hands of the whole thing. You make whatever arrangements you want. I'm not making any more arrangements for marriage. That's what he had done. He's very, very disappointed in this matter. And later on, then we now are coming to the point of understanding, I think, that and what makes it hard for us to understand Varnashram Dharma is within ISKCON, which was supposed to be, if not Vaishnava, at least Brahminical, if not Brahminical, at least Varnashram Dharma, something, we've had very bad experiences of human relations in general. And most of all, as I mentioned, we've had very bad experiences of abuse of power. And I think we've also become quite skeptical about some of Srila Prabhupada's teachings about renunciation. Because in the Bhagavatam and in what Prabhupada emphasized, there's definitely a strain of preaching that's, I can only call, anti-family. Right, the dark well of householder life, and how the strong preaching to become renounced, to become detached, to not be attached to wife, children, husband, spouse, village, whatever. Right, that's a huge, very deep strain of teachings, I want to say that this kind of teaching was originally designed for a Varnashram society, a village life, where people were rooted in village life. Just like you see today, people in India, sometimes they still are like that. In America, the unit of false ego is the individual, or in the West, I should say, the unit of false ego is the individual. In India, it's still the family. That's the unit of false ego. I mean, people are embedded in families like you can't imagine. And this is left over from the agrarian days, where it's still being modernized. Imagine living in one place and never being 25 miles outside of this village. Imagine your ancestors, as far back as anyone knows, they lived in this village. Every place you know, you recognize It's where you grew up. It's where you're rooted. You know, we need the need for roots is there in human life. Human life is meant for village of these close ties of bondage. So naturally, human life is meant for self-realization, one has to become detached from that. And so very, very heavy preaching that's against, you know, the village, against the... You know, material happiness is gramya sukha, village happiness. Material talk is gramya kata, village talk. It's all villages. Now, what happens when Prabhupada comes with the same discussion about detachment, not forming, not being attached to family, not being attached to work, not to people who are already alienated, uprooted, and have superficial human relationships everywhere, whose own family is, you know, maybe disappeared and while they were 5 or 6 or 7 years old, who don't even know what a real family life is. And what did we say? Hey, we're already detached. This is a cinch. Because, you know, I mean, and Prabhupada saw that especially his initial people were that he appealed to were the hippies who were really uprooted and alienated and detached. But this detachment was very interesting sort of detachment. Because we are not attached to family, not attached to work, not attached to success, not attached to anything, but we still wanted to enjoy. That was the problem. And this not being attached in so many ways with still a strong desire to enjoy, that's called criminal class. So, in some ways, you see, this teaching of Prabhupada to a criminal class backfired. It had unintended consequences. Prabhupada came and his method was try that, see if it works, doesn't work, try something else, try this, try that. He says, you know, he proceeded by trial and error. And so it's different. To have no human feelings, no ability to make commitments, to have no deep relations, is a different thing from genuine detachment. The first is a mental disease. And so many of the problems that we had in our movement and people didn't know what to do, you know. Here you are, you get married, a husband and wife, and the first thing you say is, don't form any relationship. You're going to be married, but you're going to be like brahmacharis and brahmas. Don't get attached to your wife. Don't get attached to your husband. And when you have children, don't get attached to your children. And God, you know what we said? Don't let the children get attached to you. I mean, that's a formula for disaster. And that's part of the problems that we had. And right now, I think that these problems, then the problems we had with the Gurukul, or the problems we had with marital relations, the abuse of authority, that's because somehow or other, various structures were put on us and we weren't ready for it yet. That's all. And I think Prabhupada at first overestimated us. I'm talking about the sins of the first generation here. We have to own up to it, all our mistakes. And we were the first ones to receive these teachings from Srila Prabhupada. And I think it was... You know, just how fallen and how far things had gone was a gradual education for Srila Prabhupada. And he began to realize. And at certain points he tried to change things and we didn't respond. Like, for example, he said it was a society for first-class men. And then he made a criticism of us, which is so devastating if you think about it. His criticism was, you think my books are just for distributing and not for studying. we should study these books. We just kept on distributing. It's devastating criticism. At one point he said, now we have expanded enough. It is time to boil the milk. He already saw that we're growing and growing and growing. There wasn't proper management. There were all kinds of people be put into position they weren't trained to fulfill. Now let's stop and boil the milk. Nobody stopped. You know, we didn't stop. For whatever reasons. So this is what, and now today, my personal judgment, human relations in ISKCON now are far better than they were in the good old days when Prabhupada was here. The only balancing thing was Prabhupada's presence. Otherwise, as far as I was concerned, if you weren't really absorbed in spiritual life, life in ISKCON was total hell. The only thing was is that it was possible in the middle of all that to become Krishna conscious, God knows how. But you could do it if you were really interested. And that was the benediction. But a lot of us, you know, joined and stayed in the movement in spite of the devotees. And the abuse of power was there from the very beginning. Temple presidents, GBCs, Sankirtan leaders, husbands, I mean, anybody who had any power over anybody else, Gurukula teachers, you managed to have no sense of community, of mutual obligation, and so on like that, because people were already uprooted, alienated, a criminal class of people. And, you know, for 12 years, I mean, not only was Prabhupada the only advanced devotee in the movement, he was the only grown-up. And so for this reason, now we are getting the reaction to this. But I mean, but the reaction is coming now from many years ago. I think things have actually improved substantially and have been going on in the right direction. So one has to understand why I'm saying is one part, when Prabhupada starts about Varnashram Dharma, part of it is how to be attached. It's not only how to be detached, we have to learn, but also for those who are not ready for detached life, one has to learn how properly to be attached. And in order to have family relationships, in order to have social relationships, if that's not there, there's going to be all kinds of social and psychological diseases in this way. So maybe I'll stop now for discussion and questions and comments. Yes?
Could you please give an example of a social disease that comes from not having that attachment?
Yeah, there has to be long-term commitment between husbands and wives, for example. It's not possible to have long-term commitment without becoming attached. Prabhupada said family members are natural objects of affection. If you want to be in a family and have a wife, have a husband, have children, you cannot be attached. Very rarely. Children especially, I mean, need that in environment. I mean, maybe tomorrow I think we'll talk about family life and children and so on like that. There has to be human feelings for these things. You see, what it is in the Varnashram system. There's not only the Varnas, but there are the Ashrams. So there's periods to be detached, and there's periods where it's proper to be attached. And the way it is there's householder life 1/4. Preceding is brahmachari, and after that vanaprastha and sannyas. At least for the Brahmins, there's these four. And so So if you do it properly, Brahma, this Varna system is very, very nice, because Prabhupada says for the first 5 years a child should be spoiled. And we'll talk about what that means later, and who's the best person to spoil them, and how they should do it, because Prabhupada actually mentions these things. But after that, Gurukula. Discipline. Now, first 25 years, that's the time for commitment, for idealism, for learning, for dedication, you know. When you're a young person, 18, 19, you think, you know, spiritual life is a cinch. I can conquer the world. I can, you know, do anything, do everything. I'm going to, you know, all these old adults, they've all failed. I won't be like them, you know. You're all fired up. And then about the age of 25, most of us settle down to, you know, I got some problems I got to deal with. I mean, life, maybe I don't want to head off in such a hurry. Householder life is there for most people. And that's the Prabhupada said, a concession. And so householder life means you live in a village, you raise a family. And that's a period of time where... But even though you are living as a householder, your business is still, for brahmacharis, they are supposed to be engaged in sacrifice. And for the vanaprasthas and sannyasis, they're supposed to be engaged in tapas. For the householders, what is it? It's charity. This householder community has to support the other three. Prabhupada said, see, it's very nice socialism. 1/4 is supporting 3/4. So your business, even though now you may be earning money, wealth producing, your business is support the other three. You're not allowed to forget what human life is for. And then gradually, as you grow older, renunciation's in the cards anyway. There's nothing like watching, you know, your 18-year-old bride gradually turn into, you know, an elderly grandmother to understand the nature of time and change. There's nothing like watching your cute little kids grow up and become adults. And then you notice as you get old that renunciation is in the cards no matter what you do. It's just going to happen anyway. People who want to live their lives for sense gratification, my one advice is don't grow old. In fact, don't get any older than 18. Stop right there. If you want to live a life of sense gratification, you're now going to declare war on time and you're going to lose. So the system of ashramas moves with the natural rhythms of life. So then after that, there's vanaprastha and then sannyas. Renunciation and then preparation for death. That's the natural way. So there's a time for attachment, there's a time for detachment. But if that attachment isn't done properly, isn't done right, then you're going to have social chaos. All kinds of crazy people produce. You need real human relationships, and this is something, you know, our movement has got to learn. I have a saying, maybe you've heard it, I guess it's gotten around. I have a saying about the Krishna consciousness movement that you strive very hard, you work really hard, you perform sadhana, and you make advancement, you become a pure devotee. Then you make even more advancement and you become a human being. need to become human beings. I mentioned this to Klaus Klostermeyer, spent many years as a Catholic priest, and he says, yeah, we have the same you know. He knows what I'm talking about. Anyway, this is I just wanted to get some sense of this kind of society that we're headed toward, and to understand that really those of us who have grown up in industrial modern civilization, it's almost unimaginable. Well, there's another point I want to make. This agrarian civilization, are we romanticizing this? I mean, the other accounts you read of, you know, medieval life, it sounds like total hell. And what farm life was like, you know, before industrialization came, before, and, you know, that maybe there was a reason why everybody wanted to move off the farm and go to the cities, and so on like that. You know, I mean, there was in 19th century Europe quite a reaction against industrial civilization. And it was part of the Romantic movement, and you know, medieval life became glorified once again. You had people like John Ruskin in England and William Morris, who extolled John Ruskin, wrote about Gothic medieval cathedrals and how you could see each man producing the sculptors and the carvings. You could see that there were individual artisans who were actually putting their real skill into the work and making their contribution. But now in modern life, everything looks like it's been stamped out of the same mold. There's no individuality. And so he praised, you know, the kind of organic life of pre-industrial society. And there was the arts and crafts movement in England, which was an attempt to resurrect this kind of thing. And that actually influenced Gandhi eventually, and Gandhi's ideas, and some of which Prabhupada agrees with. But you may say maybe we're romanticizing this. One feature of pre-industrial civilization was, of course, large families. People wanted large families because children are an asset. But also, there seemed to have been a very high infant mortality rate. And one can go back to one's great-grandparents and start to see, you know, 12 children, 4 surviving to adulthood. Because, and they say in pre-industrial society, diphtheria, typhus, smallpox, tetanus, and so on, these diseases, whooping cough, they killed off children at a pretty good rate, and one was always in the pre-industrial society, always burying one's children all the time. Do you want to go back to that? I thought about this actually quite a bit. You know, what they say is that in a pre-industrial, this is what the modern demography says, that in a pre-industrial society, you had a high and steady birth rate. And then when society begins to industrialize, the birth rate drops, and then gradually it becomes low and kind of fluctuating. And you also have, in a pre-industrial society, this is the period of industrialization right here. This is what India is going through or has been going through, but what the West went through back last century. And you also have a high and fluctuating death rate. Then when industrialization begins, the death rate falls like this and then becomes low and steady. And most of this is infant mortality, actually. There's this period of time where there's a gap. This is when you get the population boom. You see, this is how it's explained. This population boom when societies are undergoing industrialization, because first the death rate drops. And why does the death rate drop? It's infant mortality, and they say it's due to public health measures. That in agrarian life, there was always, you know, a huge amount of disease. When people moved in the city, then there began to be sanitation, clean water, so there was no cholera and tetanus and so on, and communicable diseases. Food was better taken care of and so on. And so because of public health measures and preventative medicine, not so much like vaccines and things like that, or cures, the infant mortality rate went down. First. Then gradually people began to have, after that, fewer children. That gradually began to drop off also. And now in modern societies like in America and Europe, at least the industrialized section of society you know, the population is not growing, it's stable or even decreasing. It's only people from the third world who haven't gotten the news yet who are still having, you know, 8-10 kids and outproducing everybody else, which is considerable worry to a country like Israel, that where the, you know, the Jewish people are here and the Palestinians are here. You're here, rather, because the death rate's dropped. Why so much disease in agrarian life? And from what I've been reading about diseases, and I've looked at this a while, the breeding ground for disease is animals. That's where disease organisms are stored up and where they mutate. The flu germ, apparently, the flu virus that comes around every year mutating, the place it seems to mutate is in China, where there's a very interesting relationship between ducks, pigs, and fish. And pig stool being fed to fish, and so on. And in the intestines of all these various animals, the flu germ undergoes mutation and everything that comes out. So now I realize what happens. In Europe, the domestic animals are pigs, sheep, chickens, and some cattle, but all these other things. In India, the domestic animals in Vedic culture are cows. Cows are healthy for human beings to live with. But these pigs are not healthy, sheep are not healthy, ducks are not healthy, chickens are not healthy, cats are not healthy, dogs are not healthy. And if you go to any traditional Vedic village, you won't see all these animals. Who raises the pigs? Well, again, the Saurabhas or some other tribal people, but not in Vedic culture. I would submit that if you have a Vedic culture in which the domestic animals are, for the most part, simply cows, there will not be this rate of highly infectious diseases. That's my hypothesis. We'll see. So many of the things that we know from European history of rural or agricultural life will not apply, I think, to one based on an actual Vedic culture. And part of that will be, you know, the fact that it's based on cows. Yeah.
So do the figures bear that out, with the families who are raising a sheep farm or raising a lot of pigs? Kind of,
I don't think anyone's ever studied like that, but just generally, I was reading some articles about epidemiology. I mean, how diseases grow and spread, and the place where diseases brew up and enter into the human population is animals. Syphilis was originally a disease of animals. It spread to the human population. Traditionally in Europe, it was thought to have been a disease of sheep. It then became a disease of a shepherd because of having intimate relationships with sheep, and so on. Prabhupada attributes it to the same thing with dogs. But whatever the case may be, it was originally an animal disease that moved into human society because of too much intimacy with beasts. That's what. Most diseases come into how you live with the animals is very important. The cow is clean. It's a clean animal. The cow dung kills the germs, and you can see how it works in Vedic culture. Anything else you want to talk about? Time to go. Okay. So, okay, well, tomorrow we'll go on and try to talk about the next step in this thing is about how to be attached. Forgiveness is from Maharaj, of course. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Yeah.